Let's start the Greater Minnesota Economic and Workforce Development Policy Committee for Thursday, January 29th. Today we have an overview of Minnesota housing, from Minnesota Housing, and with that, Representative Hancock, did you read the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I have, and I would move the minutes of January 27th.
Very well. Representative Hancock moved the minutes of January 27th. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Commissioner Tingerthal, we would love to have you grace us with your wonderful presentation with the persons officially now in your department. Ryan, we're glad to have you.
Thank you, Representative.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Tingerthal, and I'm commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And to my left is Ron Baumtrog, who is our new assistant commissioner for policy and community development on his second day on the job. So we're happy to be here and have this opportunity to talk to you about Minnesota housing. There should be two things in your package relating to our presentation, a copy of our PowerPoint, and then a copy of our last year's program assessment, which will give you probably more information about the use of funds at Minnesota Housing and who we serve. The next version of that, which will include our 2014 activity, will be delivered to the committee in February.
So we'll
see that then. Okay, Minnesota Housing, we are a state agency that is an independent agency with a board of directors that is appointed by the governor, and it's a seven-member board that also includes the state auditor. We have been in existence for a little over 40 years, and we have been in all that time delivering various kinds of financing programs for low and moderate income households to have a safe, sound, and affordable roof over their heads. We have the authority legally to issue tax-exempt bonds, and we also administer a number of other federal programs. And we actually are a rated entity, and we carry on a standalone basis, separate from the state of Minnesota, a AA1, AA+ credit rating. Our mission is to finance affordable housing for low and moderate income households while fostering strong communities. We feel very strongly about that strong communities language, and we'll be talking a lot today about what it takes to make strong communities. And we try to work not just financing housing anywhere, but working with communities on meeting their greatest housing needs. The current environment for housing, the need for affordable housing is large, and it's been growing. You've heard probably a lot about income disparities across the country. But in Minnesota, just to give you the hometown view, about 600,000 households are what we call cost burdened. And you might ask, what does that phrase mean? Cost burden means that that household is paying more than 30% of their income for their housing costs, whether that's rent or whether that's a home mortgage, but that is the number of families that are paying more than that 30%. Sadly, 8 to 10,000 Minnesotans at the last count were also homeless, the worst kind of cost burden. Right now, there are low rental vacancy rates, and you'll hear about that from several speakers today, that in many communities around the state, there are virtually 0% vacancy rates, and that oftentimes mean that rents have been going up as incomes have been remaining stable, and therefore the gap of affordability gets even bigger. Something else you hear about today is rising construction costs. We've seen over the last several years, since the end of the Great Recession, that it's very expensive to build, both in the metro area and greater Minnesota, with pressures especially in the western half of the state from the Bakken oil fields. We also have growing preservation needs. There are many units of housing that were financed by Minnesota Housing and oftentimes the federal government located throughout the state of Minnesota that are 35 and 40 years old. And this legislature has been has seen fit over the years to provide through Minnesota Housing dollars to be able to invest in those properties so that we keep them safe and sound and good places for people to live. Many of those properties are located in county seats around the state as well as smaller communities as well. I'm very pleased to say that the foreclosure rate is declining. When I took this position 4 years ago, we were dealing with some of the highest foreclosure rates experienced since the Great Depression. And we've been very fortunate in Minnesota to have even a faster recovery of our economy, our jobs, and therefore a declining foreclosure rate, and house prices really returning more to their levels before the Great Recession. However, there continue to be a lot of barriers to accessing homeownership for families that are of modest means, and I'll talk a little bit more about what we do at Minnesota Housing to mitigate that problem. Very quickly, if you take a look at our strategic plan, we have five strategic priorities. First is to preserve that federally assisted rental housing that I spoke of. Secondly, to promote and support successful home ownership. And I emphasize the successful home ownership. Minnesota Housing did experience some run-up in our delinquency rates and during the Great Recession, but because everyone who got a mortgage from Minnesota Housing got a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage that was fully underwritten, we did not suffer the same kinds of foreclosure and delinquency rates that the market did at large. Number three is to address specific and critical needs in rental housing markets. As we went around the state 4 years ago and ever since then in some of the places we'll show you later, we have heard that needs around the state really differ a lot from one place to the next. In one place, there might be a shortage of large family housing. In other places, there may be a shortage of ownership housing. And we try to put our resources out there in ways that are flexible enough to meet a wide range of needs. And finally, preventing foreclosures and supporting community recovery. I think when you see our new strategic plan next year, you'll see that we'll take less of a focus on needing to prevent foreclosures and more focus on the supporting community recovery, which still needs to be done in a fair number of communities. For those of you who don't know us well, I thought it would be good to review our sources of funding. We, in our affordable housing plan in 2014, projected the spending of about $800 million, and the sources of that are quite varied. As you can see on the left side of the diagram in the blue, the largest portion of the capital that we put on the street through our delivery networks is from tax-exempt bond proceeds or other mortgage capital. About 26% in the red are from federal funds, and less than 9% of the funds are from state appropriations. We also do use resources from the Minnesota Housing balance sheet, both amortizing loans from our Pool 2 and deferred loans from our Pool 3 resources. In 2015, that total spending is $954 million projected. With regard to state appropriations, I always think it's important to point out that this agency does not use any state appropriations for agency administrative costs. Every dollar that you appropriate is used directly into programs that serve Minnesotans. To give you an idea of how those dollars are allocated, about 56% go to serve households below $12,000 annual median income, and about 61% serve households with median annual incomes below $19,500. We do have a number of programs, which I'll show you in a minute, that really serve a wider range of income levels, but in terms of where the state appropriations have been focused, it has been on our lower income families. Now, the use of funding, and this is all of our funding sources, not just the appropriations, go into a number of categories. The largest are federal funds that go into federal rental assistance, along with our Housing Trust Fund and our Bridges Program, which are state-funded rental assistance. Homebuyer programs, where last year we served over 3,000 households, are in the red, our second largest category. And then the blue category is non-capital resources to prevent and end homelessness. Regarding our program delivery, many people don't know that Minnesota Housing does not own or operate any housing. We actually deliver nearly all of our assistance through a network of private delivery partners. In the case of our single family programs, we deliver those programs through a network of lenders, community lenders that you'll be very familiar with, who make loans, and then we provide the funding to capitalize those loans. Developers and property managers, so in our multifamily programs, we generally award most of our funds through a competitive process where developers who will own the properties over the long term come in and propose what kind of housing they will develop in those communities, and then they own and manage that housing over the long term. And finally, social service providers. We work closely with other resources from the state to make sure that for those that need housing, that includes supportive services, also are served by the same folks that, so they don't have to go to multiple service providers. The programs are accessed by these different parties through a variety of resources. The two most common are our consolidated request for proposals. It's a once-a-year competition, very open. We publish our criteria, and we typically receive anywhere from 3 to 5 times the number of proposals for the resources we make available as we have available in any given year. We try to allocate all of our resources through the same process so that a wide variety of housing can be, and a wide variety of resources can be accessed all at the same time. We also do run some programs on a pipeline basis, notably our single family mortgage programs. Currently, the way we're funding them, they're available generally all year long. So what's our impact? How many people might experience a Minnesota Housing program in the course of a year? Well, in 2013, which is the program assessment you have, almost 63,000 households. About 2,000 of those units were for either new affordable rental units or the preservation of affordable rental units that already existed. About 75% of the renters that were assisted had incomes under $20,000. For mortgages, about almost 2,800 mortgages, 23% to households of color. And in 2014, when you see our new report, you'll see that that has increased to 26% households of color. Our median annual income for home buyers that are assisted is about $48,500. All told, that's $782 million in total resources allocated, and that number will match with the numbers that are in our program assessment. I'm not going to go into detail today at all of our different programs, but this next slide will show you what we think of as our housing continuum. At the left side of the graph, you see our homelessness prevention programs. This is our family homeless prevention program, where we literally work with social service agencies to provide small grants to individuals who are literally facing homelessness. It's been found with this program as well as nationally, that if you can prevent a family from becoming homeless, far more cost-effective than allowing that family to actually become homeless and enter our shelter system. The median income of households that are served with that program, as you might imagine, is very low at about $9,000. The next step up is what we call supportive housing. This is permanent, affordable rental housing with supportive services for people who have experienced homelessness. A large proportion of this population is people who suffer from multiple kinds of life stresses, such as disabilities, mental illness, chemical dependency. And in supportive housing, it gives them an opportunity to have a roof over their head while they access the human services that they need to overcome those barriers and really live a successful life. This is a very time-tested model with, I believe it's 88% of people going into supportive housing either are still in stable housing after 2 years and either they have exited successfully to another program or to market rate housing. Again, not surprisingly, the median incomes of these households range from about $8,000 to $10,000. We then move to affordable rental housing. This is the new construction or acquisition and rehabilitation of affordable rental housing and the preservation of existing affordable housing that's subsidized by the federal government. Median household incomes, depending on which program, range from about $8,000 for projects that are subsidized by federal rental assistance up to $22,000 for housing where we have access to less deep subsidies. And last but certainly not least is our affordable home ownership programs. Mortgages for first-time home buyers, home improvement loans for low-income families that may already own a home and need a little help fixing it up, including things like energy conservation programs, and also a limited amount of single-family development with serving median incomes in the range of about $20,000 to $63,000. Since the governor's budget was released on Tuesday, I thought I might give this committee a preview of what all of our programs are and what historically the funding levels have been and what the proposal is this year. You'll hear most from me in the next few minutes about the very first line item, which is our Housing and Economic Development Challenge Fund. And you'll see that last biennium, the base there was $18.4 million. This year, the proposal, what was in the tails and what is in the governor's proposal is $25.8 million. The next three programs, the Housing Trust Fund, Bridges, and Family Homeless Prevention, are at the core of our homelessness prevention and mitigation efforts. Our Homeownership Assistance Fund is a small but incredibly important source of down payment assistance for those first-time home buyers that need a little help in being able to cover their down payment and closing costs. Our Preservation Program, known as PARIF, is also an important program for preserving those houses or those rental properties with federal rental assistance. Rental Rehab Loans is a program that's entirely focused on rural Minnesota properties to help owners of small properties to rehabilitate them. Homeownership Rehab Loans, this is a program for very, very low-income homeowners that need to make essentially emergency repairs to their home. HECAT stands for Home Ownership Education, Counseling, and Training. And this supports our home buyer and foreclosure prevention counseling. Capacity building, we cover funding for a number of organizations such as Housing Link, which is an online service where people can find affordable housing, and Homeline, which helps people with legal problems related to rental housing. And you'll see that the special initiatives that were funded in the 14-15 year were largely rolled into that capacity building base, with a small portion being rolled into the Housing Trust Fund. There is a one increase that I would note for you recommended in the governor's proposal, and that's in the third line for the Bridges program. This is a program of rental assistance for people with serious mental illness, and it is aligned with our strategies for deconcentrating people with disabilities that may be in institutions.
Representative Miller has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thank you very much for being here. On that budget proposal, I go to the previous slide where you have the housing continuum. What's the rough balance of those four categories that the budget, that the governor's proposal, I mean, how is it emphasized? How does it lay out on that? So is it like a 25, 25, 25, 25 percentage? Is there one that's emphasized a little bit more in his proposal? I just am not aware of all these programs, so.
Right.
But I understand that right there.
Right.
So if you could help me with that, I would appreciate it. Thank
right.
you.
Right. What I would say is that historically, because you typically need to use appropriated dollars for people at the lowest end of the income scale, if you take the Housing Trust Fund, Bridges, and Family Homeless Prevention, those three items together, that is far and away the largest portion of the funded programs. The next emphasis, I would say, is frankly in our challenge fund, because that is our most flexible fund to be able to support a wide variety of housing development and rehabilitation, and it is a program that is focused on workforce housing.
Okay. Thank you. I'll have a question a little bit later about workforce housing, but I'll wait on that. Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and seeing as how the Commissioner brought it up, where did you put the workforce housing? In the 11 county metro area or the 76 county greater Minnesota area? I had to do the math real quick in my head.
If I could ask Representative Mahoney if he would be willing to wait for about two slides.
Well, we'll see. I'm getting more patient as I get older.
But if it's not answered to your satisfaction, I will elaborate more. So I did want for this particular committee to focus on the long-term commitment that Minnesota Housing has had to the development of workforce housing, both in the metro area and in greater Minnesota. As the chair of this committee well knows, the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program, which we affectionately refer to as Challenge, it has been a resource for communities since 1999. We, in the late 90s, also were experiencing a shortage of workforce housing, and it was then that we literally put the challenge on the table to have local employers, local communities step up and bring money to the table to help for the development of housing in their communities. And it is a requirement of our rule for the program that at least 50% of the projects that are funded out of the challenge program must have a local match coming either from employers or from local communities.
Representative Miller.
I promise my questions are very quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you actually, I was going to wait on this question a little bit, but you brought it up right now. I just came out of a meeting out of where workforce needs in my district were emphasized. So I was wondering if you had any data on the workforce needs in greater Minnesota, so how many units are needed, what regions are probably most in need, because that's one of the challenges of, when we talk about workforce housing, I know we all know what that means, but workforce is a real issue for the jobs that I already have in my district. So I'm just curious if you have what the needs are.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, if I could ask your indulgence until slide number 15.
Now I don't feel so wrong. I think we're building relations across the aisle.
There you go. Okay, thank you. That's all.
So we just took a look at the last 5 years, even though Challenge has existed for 15 years. And in that time, in Greater Minnesota, that's outside the seven-county metro area, Challenge has been used to help develop 382 units of affordable rental housing and 368 homeownership opportunities. So, you know, to say that Challenge doesn't work in Greater Minnesota is perhaps an overstatement. And I do also want to indicate that the Challenge income limits are limited at 80% of the statewide median income. That's $58,000 for rental housing. So anywhere in the state, regardless of what your local median income is, you can go up to that level and utilize Challenge funds, and 115% of statewide median income for home ownership. So we found those to be quite large limits in our experience, and some that are not perhaps well understood.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one thing that's not on the slide is, you know, how many housing units in total statewide did you do, including the seven-county metro area? So, I mean, this is just over 750 units of housing in Greater Minnesota. Is that all the housing that you did over the last 5 years, or did you do a lot more and most of it came into the metro area, or what? Where did you put them?
Or is that another slide a little later?
No. As a matter of fact, what I can do is either provide you with that or ask you to look at one of the pages in our program assessment. And maybe grab me. Since we're about to publish the new one, we were literally pulling together copies of this to bring for you today. If you look at page 28, this tells you by region the amount of assistance and the funding source for 2013. We also have a report which is available on our website, and I would be happy to provide that to the committee members. We call this our regional distribution of Minnesota housing assistance, and that provides you with a look over the last 5 years, quite detailed about the share of assisted housing compared to where low-income families live, and probably more detail than you ever cared to know about where the housing has been located over the last 5 years. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I'd be happy to provide this report to members of the committee if you'd like us to do that.
That would be wonderful.
Continuing with page 13 of the PowerPoint presentation, we have other resources besides Challenge that go into Greater Minnesota. Our federal home dollars, which have been a shrinking resource, housing infrastructure bonds, low-income housing tax credits, which is our main resource for producing new rental housing, and the low-income housing tax credits in Greater Minnesota, which is, as I say, one of our most important resources, over the last 5 years has produced 830 units of new construction housing in Greater Minnesota. So even during a time when we weren't doing a lot of new construction, we have supported the development of tax credit housing in Greater Minnesota, in places like Jackson, Grand Rapids, Thief River Falls, etc.
Representative Miller.
Thank you. Sorry, Commissioner. Thank you, Chair. Sorry, Commissioner. I ask all the questions. Hopefully, they're real. These are good numbers. What does it reflect in the total overall need? When you hear questions in this committee, I kind of am jumping to the conclusion of Greater Minnesota, so I apologize for that. But there's a number of units that are addressed. What is there? A couple slides ahead that I jumped on. What the overall need is?
We will be getting to that. Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. I better just ask questions at the end. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Going to page number 14. We became concerned, quite honestly, 4 years ago, that we were not seeing enough good competitive applications coming from Greater Minnesota. We said, you know, maybe we've gotten too complicated. Maybe people in our communities don't know how to interact with us very well. And so we have frankly been on a campaign of meeting with local communities to find out more about what their housing needs are. And we found that a number of things work pretty well. One thing that really helps communities a lot to focus on what their housing needs are is to do a housing study. And there are a number of organizations, including the Minnesota Housing Partnership, some of the local initiative funds, and Greater Minnesota Housing Fund that have funded housing studies in a number of communities around the state in recent years. It's just a good basis. It tells you what kind of housing do we need, how many of them do we need, what ranges of incomes are there, what kinds of rents might we be able to charge. They're really very, very helpful. We then often, in those communities that have done a housing study, there's often a desire for local businesses, community leaders, elected officials to actually get together and say, okay, what are we going to do about this? And we have sponsored a number of those dialogues, which I'll go over in just a second. Then building relationships with the development community. Many times we've been asked by community leaders to bring developers that have done housing development in other communities that have successfully accessed money from Minnesota Housing to come and sit down with them and see if there's a fit for that particular community. Then it's usually a local process of prioritizing their needs. What is the thing that's at the top of that community's list? And it's not the same for every community. And we just try to facilitate that discussion in figuring out where they want to focus. And then we try to work with them to get technical assistance and submit applications. And again, two of our private sector partners that do a lot of this work with communities are the Minnesota Housing Partnership and the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. Now getting Representative Miller to page number 15. Now I know that this doesn't address your community, but I wanted to give you these as examples. These happen to be five communities in Greater Minnesota that over the last 3 years have completed housing studies. And they range in size from Lake of the Woods County, the entire county with just over 4,000 people, to the city of Duluth with 86,000 people. I've given you the year of the study to just give you a little bit of an idea of when the work was done. And you'll see that in each and every case, there is a need for affordable rental, market rental, and entry-level home ownership in each and every case. And in many cases, what we have said to communities when they say, well, you know, we don't need affordable housing, you know, pointing to the study that says, well, if you have a community that has a 0% vacancy rate and a need for housing, often we can relieve the pressure on the need for housing in that community by helping to support an affordable rental property, and that can sometimes free up units in the market rate sector as well. So we just give you these illustrative. There are many more studies that have been done around the state, but it really, we do find, is a good starting point for communities to begin to grapple with what they really need to fight for in their community.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, is there a place where we on the committee could actually go and see what communities around the state have done housing studies? Do you have a list? You've got, 15 or 20 here on this housing community dialogue, but you say there's lots more. Is there a place on your website where we can go look at them?
Representative Mahoney, Mr. Chair, since this is not something that we fund or that we mandate, it's an informal list of places that we happen to know that housing studies have been done, but we'd be happy to pull that together and send that to the community. That won't be a comprehensive list because there may be others that have been done.
Well, it would be really good if we're spending a tremendous amount of time on housing and on workforce housing. It'd be really good for the committee to understand who has done all of these housing studies. And frankly, I'll bet you there's been a million of them in my neck of the woods, but it'd be nice to know whether Greater Minnesota, Northern or Southern or Western Minnesota have done these and be able to, science is an interesting thing. Once in a while it works, and maybe we can direct more money to where it needs to go that way. So I know you can do an informal one, but maybe you could also direct the committee assistant where she might find a more formal or be able to pull together a bigger list. I'd always like to give staff more work to do.
All right, we will we'll pull together the list that we have.
Thank you.
Staff will look for another list.
Going on to page 16, I did want to let you know where we have convened housing and community dialogues over the last 3 years, or the last 2 years, and where we are thinking that we will go this year. The ones in 2015 are in the planning stages, and the timing of them will really be driven by the local communities. We find that we have a lot more participation and commitment when the community decides when to have the meeting and who to invite to it. So that's the way we set them up. Some of the other housing discussions that we've been involved in over the last several years, City of Duluth had a housing summit last February. Olmsted County had a large housing summit about 17 months ago. They have a major need for housing as a result of the development there. There have been separate workforce housing discussions that our staff has participated in Roseau, Thief River Falls, Worthington, and Jackson, where we've responded to invitations from those communities. The Minnesota Housing Partnership is an organization, as I mentioned, that we work with that has held what are called Minnesota Housing Partnership Institutes. This is where there are often several days where city staff and local people get together. And in 2014, the three that were done were in Itasca County, Thief River Falls, and Roseau County. And the ones scheduled for 2015 are in East Central Minnesota, Central Minnesota, West Central Minnesota, and in the city of Cloquet. So we try not to duplicate efforts. If there are other resources that are being brought to bear, we try to piggyback on those and try to get the most out of resources that local communities are pulling together. We also have appeared at conferences and discussions sponsored by the Minnesota Association of Development Organizations and the Minnesota Economic Development Association. So lots of discussion. We like to try to let communities know what might be available. We've given you a couple of examples of Roseau. We convened one of our earliest workforce housing discussions there, where a housing study was done, proved that a market need existed. we were asked by the community to bring some additional developers to the table. There was a housing proposal that was submitted, and an application was funded and will break ground this spring. In Thief River Falls, a housing study showed low vacancy rates, long commutes. I know you're going to hear from the city of Thief River Falls in a few minutes, so I won't go into more detail there. But what I will say is that out of the Housing and Job Growth Initiative, 24 units of rental housing were funded. We also were involved not with financing, but through our partner, Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, which is a private nonprofit organization, helped to develop 41 units of investor equity-driven rental housing that came out of the same discussions. And we also worked with a single-family developer to leverage contributions from the city, Hallmark Homes, DigiKey, and had money from the Housing and Job Growth Initiative. So we do think we have a good track record of working with communities to develop workforce housing, and happy to answer any further questions about that. I am over my 30 minutes, so I'll ask the chair if he would like me to continue or would like me to stop at this point. We can quickly go through the last few slides.
We'll never get through a full agenda anyway. We're going to try to get those people done that live out of town, so we do have a little time. Please continue.
Okay. So just to summarize, and this is getting to Representative Miller's points about what the need is. On page 22, the homeownership gap. We are a state of homeowners, by and large, but we have the third highest homeownership rate in the nation, but we have the third worst disparity in homeownership rates between white households and households of color. And this is particularly critical as we see the number of households of color growing in Greater Minnesota, and many with large families working in our agricultural businesses and really not having the resources to be able to buy a home. This is shown pretty dramatically on slide number 23. You can see that overall the homeownership rate in Minnesota is almost 72%. It was as high as 76% before the crash. For white households, that's 76% of households, down from almost 80% before the crash. But for households of color, it's down around 40%. So we have a number of programs at Minnesota Housing that are directed to try to close that gap and really provide all first-time homebuyer households that are of modest income, but especially with a focus on households of color. This year, when you see our program report, you'll see that 26% of our mortgage products have gone to households of color. Part of that has been from a very special program on homeownership capacity that has provided counseling dollars to organizations that work in our ethnic communities to help people map a path to becoming homeowners. The second thing is really getting to Representative Miller's question, and that is, what's the need? So 28% of Minnesotans pay more than 30% of their income for housing. That's 600,000 households. But over all the years, the 40 years that Minnesota Housing has been helping to finance housing in Minnesota, at the bottom of the page you'll see that only about 100,000 units around the state have some sort of subsidy that's baked into the property that keeps them at affordable levels by some sort of agreement with those owners. So 600,000 households, 100,000 sort of affordable units that you can count on. Now, certainly there are other units in the marketplace that are at rents that are affordable, but I'm just trying to address the public policy question of how much have we done over the years and how big is that gap that still exists. That's It's gone down a little bit from 30% of Minnesotans in 2013, but that's almost entirely because things have gotten better for the homeowners in the state. And you can see that on the next slide, where renters, 48% of renters are paying more than 30% of their income for housing, while 21% of homeowners are paying more than 30% of income for housing.
Representative Miller has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I apologize. I'm trying to absorb all this information.
No problem.
So I don't want to be a problem. I just want to make sure that you understand my question. What I'm interested in is the data on the need for it. So let me give you a small example. So like I have Renville in my I go Renville County instead of Renville Town, but Renville County, it's identified that there is a need of X number of workforce housing units that are going to be needed. And then how does that look? And I'm not even necessarily looking for every single data number down there, because that's a lot of numbers. But if we can get a feel for where these needs are, I think we can prioritize and make, because what you're asking, what you're asking for is what we're going to be spending money on. And so I just want to make sure that I'm comfortable voting for something that is addressing the needs for the people that have the most interest in it. So if there's anywhere that we can access that data, just to see what the assumed need is. I don't know. Am I kind of asking the same question you're asking, or is it totally different? You weren't listening to me, were you? Anyway, does that make sense, Commissioner?
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Miller, Mr. Chair, there really are a couple of different definitions of need, and what I would say is that when it comes to a very local level, it really does take doing a housing study to say, you know, in Renville, this is what the situation is at this snapshot in time. This is how many housing units there are. And that's why these local housing studies, frankly, are so important, because what's true in one community may not be true in a separate community that's 20 miles down the road. And so it's important to understand on a pretty local level. The other thing that I would say, however, is that another definition of need is really more based around a question of ability to afford any housing at all. So it's a question of where are the physical units, and then what's the need for help in affording those units. And those are the statistics that you'll see in the back of our program report, where what we try to look at is where do people with greater housing needs from an income standpoint, where do they live, and how do we allocate resources on that basis? So I think as we go through these discussions, and I'm sure this won't be the last one that we have, okay. I think it's important to remember that they're both that sort of physically, are there any units at all? And then the question of affordability.
And Mr. Chair, just real quickly, if I could, because the concern for me is out by me, we're talking about workforce development. And so there's a need based off of income, but there's a need where I have companies that won't move to my area because they don't have the workforce. So there is no perceived need there because the people aren't there. So one of the things that I think we're talking about this session is how can we, it sounds like workforce housing is one of our challenges to be able to develop the economy of greater Minnesota. So if that's one of our challenges, how we address that. So I'm hoping that those local studies make it up the pipeline to you so that we can have those numbers, because that's where I think we're going to be able to make those decisions the best. Thank you. And I'll stop talking, I promise.
Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, as Representative Miller said, we want to make the right decisions with the best dollars. I just happen to be looking at the budget proposal that you have in your slides. And looking at it, looks like you actually have a decline in your base. And that made me concerned, because housing, especially in greater Minnesota, and workforce development is important. I have a little bit of concern on the 14-15 baseline. When I actually add up those numbers and remove that $3 million of excess, you're about $16 million short when you add these numbers up to your 101. It only comes up to $85 million. And that'd be a big difference between being a 1% decrease in your base to about a 17% increase in your base. Is there some funds that you have listed on here that did not get on that baseline? I'm looking for some accurate information so we can make some good decisions.
I'm sorry, we will certainly check the math. I don't think we missed anything, but it's entirely possible in the preparation of the slide that we did.
If you could get back to the committee administrator, we should get it across to everybody. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Commissioner. To Representative Miller, back in the day when I was a city administrator some time ago, we did a needs assessment in a town of 231 people, and we ended up building 10% of our entire town housing within 3 years, and it's been 100% full. So it is done. And also, one of the things we did was the EDA in that little tiny community did a needs assessment and a quantification of what businesses were going to move to town if we had that. And I'd suggest that, you know, the local community, regardless of how small, you know, worked at more than just we had a citizens committee, we had the city council, we had the EDA. And then we had the county, and some assistance was got from them. That way we could figure out, well, if we did this, what would happen? What would be the result? But my question to the commissioner is, do you get a lot? One of the ways to make houses more affordable, particularly in the last, during the 07-08 time when the interest rates were significant, all interest rates are significant, I don't want to categorize that. Have you received a lot of requests from homeowners who have high mortgages that come to you and higher mortgages and come to you and ask for assistance to understand how to refinance, what points mean, what mortgage origination fees mean, and how, rather than just going into a bank and listening to a salesperson, you know, because they're good at what they do. And so that's my question.
Commissioner.
Representative, yes, absolutely. We take that as a big part of our mission. We don't do that directly with Minnesota Housing staff, but we provide funding, and also there is federal funding available to an organization called the Home Ownership Center, which provides a statewide network of homebuyer counselors, and they have also developed an award-winning online instructional program where people can learn at their own pace. It goes into all of the details about issues of, you know, how much home can you afford, how do you deal with your debt, what kind of home to look for, what to watch out for when you start working with your realtor, what to watch out for when you start working with your lender, and be happy to provide the committee with that information. It's something, frankly, we're very, very proud of.
Then the last question, and I don't know the answer to this, but I do know what the answer was back in the early 80s when I did a project housing in what is now my legislative district. It was really scattered. Our community that I just described was really kind of like on its own of sorts, and we had to figure all this out along the way, and who to talk to and who not to talk to, and how to formulate that plan to get to the day that you could get the funding to get the housing. Do you have available to a small community, particularly that has less resources, a step-by-step guidance manual that says you do this, this, this? For example, one of the things that happened in our community is we went through this whole planning process but didn't realize we had to do a HUD income survey, and so we got started late, delayed the process by at least a year, and that's how small we actually were and how much resources we had to work with. And so I just wonder, do you have a step-by-step action plan for communities, whether they're big or small? Big ones have people.
Representative and Mr. Chair, yes, we do work with communities to walk them through our process. And we also have a person on our staff who is walking past the back of the room as we speak, Margaret Kaplan, who is our community development director, who whenever we learn of a community that is looking to do something with housing, Margaret is their first call. And she is also the one that works with communities on our housing dialogues, and she gets them connected with the right people in our housing development department.
I just have to ask one short one, Ms. Chairman. So how much reach out is there to the communities? Because I've got a couple communities that are calling me and say, you've got to pass this, you've got to pass that, we need more, we need more. But and I always go back to them. Who have you contacted to find out what's available? So is your agency waiting for people to call them, or are you out looking for people to get a hold of to explain what it is that they might or might not be able to do?
You know, we certainly do outreach by participating in a variety of programs. We have a working relationship with the League of Cities, League of Minnesota Counties. I would say that in the last 3 years, as we've done these housing dialogues, we always cast a fairly wide net. So we're not just, if we're holding a session in the city of Willmar, we're really reaching out to the surrounding areas so that people can come in. Have we reached everyone? I'm sure we haven't. But we truly are trying to do a better job of that. Mr. Chair, the typo has been discovered. back on page 11, the challenge fund should... should include $10 million, which was in the Housing and Job Growth Initiative in 2014-15. So that should be 28,406.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, what the numbers included in the FY14-15 base, they don't include some one-time appropriations that the housing agency received. So in 2014-15, they received $10 million for the housing and job growth, $2 million for rental assistance for highly mobile students, and a $1 million for reentry rent assistance. But those were just one-time and not in the base for 16 and 17. But there were some changes in last year's biennial budget that increased the tails, now our current budget, fiscal year 16 and 17, namely for the challenge program and housing trust fund, where they were increased from what they were in 14-15. So it's a little bit of a one-time appropriation in 14-15 and then an increase in 16 and 17 that makes the numbers very close.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Apologize for that.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Back to the idea of challenge grants. Part of my district is very concerned with low-income housing, and other parts of my district very concerned with major workforce housing. And I'm wondering, on accessing the challenge grants, is there any percentage requirement that is set aside that has to meet low-income requirements to access the challenge grants?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hancock, we do not set aside any amounts for low income. However, in our pointing system, in the competition, more points are given for housing that serves lower income households. So if you have two projects side by side and one serves lower income households, that project will get more points.
Answer your question.
Yeah, I think that answers the question, and I think that also then poses a challenge to those that are primarily in need of workforce housing in terms of having access to that. and maybe we ought to look at that in the development of it. In other words, I know there's some areas, in especially in northwestern Minnesota, that really need workforce housing, and they don't really have a lot of what you would call need for low-income housing. And so to try to fund that in an appropriate manner, maybe we need to look at developing a system that would have access more towards directly workforce housing. More of a comment than a question, Mr. Chair, and thank you.
Appreciate that. Commissioner, I have a question. Now, in Rochester, when they had the challenge grant there, and Mayo assisted in getting houses built for their workers, can you tell me how much input of dollars did they have, or did they get a tax credit? What part in the challenge grant did Mayo or in Marshall did Schwann's have in getting that project done?
Mr. Chair, there is a very good report that we can provide to the committee members that's been prepared by the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund that actually enumerates a number of examples where employers assisted with housing. And I would say that it is very much not a one-size-fits-all kind of solution. We tried to leave it very flexible so that employers, regardless of their size, could make a meaningful contribution, depending on whether it was Mayo Clinic or Bluefin Bay Resort up in Tofte. And those are both actual real examples where there was participation. But for example, in Rosso, Polaris is purchasing the tax credits for the project that's under development at a concessionary rate. And so that's the way that the money was put into the project. In other cases, there was land that was provided. In yet other cases, it was actually a cash grant that went into the development of the project. So there really are a wide variety of ways that employers can participate.
Thank you. Representative Norton and then Representative Mahoney.
Just a couple quick things. First, Olmsted doesn't have an A in it. And I point that out because people are getting very confused because of the Olmsted Act and the court decision. And so just to clarify that, we only are STED.
I'm sorry. I thought that had been corrected. I caught it last night.
It's happening very frequently now because of the recent court decision. So I just thought I'd point that out. Rename the county. We can be named after the lawsuit. Great. And then the second thing is, as I'm looking at this, I'm just looking for clarification after Representative Johnson had us relook at those numbers. And if I'm understanding correctly, I remember the $10 million addition that we did in 2014, and there was some question by some about why the governor's proposal didn't have an increase in it, but the reason is because we put it in the increase was put in the base and hasn't yet taken effect for, if I'm looking at this right, 2016-17. So there is, in fact, an increase. It just passed a year ago and hasn't taken effect except for the $10 million and those other examples that were given. Am I understanding that correctly?
Essentially, yes. So the base, in fact, in 14-15 was $18,000,406. There was a one-time appropriation for that same biennium of $10 million. So there is no one-time appropriation this time, but there is a $7.4 million increase in the base for 16 and 17.
Yeah, and so I just wanted to clarify that. There is actually more money for housing moving ahead, but it was done with an outdate a year ago. And so
right.
I just, in the last couple of years, we focused very seriously on housing and workforce housing in particular. And I do appreciate, and I want to thank you for the efforts that were done in Olmsted County in the very large, very interesting summit that was held last year. We had standing room only, and we're dragging people out into the halls and chairs around the edges. There's a lot of interest in it, and I thank you for your participation.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the Commissioner, is there a wage difference between low income and workforce? I mean, what do you have a wage limit on low income and then a wage limit on workforce? And then I have one other question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we do have several different programs that have different income limits. They really don't define, workforce or they really are definitions as a percentage of median income. So for the challenge fund, the maximum income of limit that has to be set for a project making use of the challenge fund is $58,000 for the entire state. And just to do the math, which we talked about at Representative Garofalo's committee last week, 30% of income for a person making $58,000 a year would allow you to pay rent of $1,450. So it's really quite a generous limitation, I would say. However, the federal low-income housing tax credit, which is frequently a tool that's used to construct housing, is limited. So to compete for that particular resource, the maximum income is 60% of the area median income. So that is a much lower threshold. So it depends on where you're located and what the area median income is. So two different thresholds for those two different resources.
Mr. Mahoney.
And there is my next question. There's a huge difference between average income, median income, and mode income. Average is you just take everybody, lump them in together, and divide them by the number. Median is you're trying to find out what that average, what that middle of the road is. And mode takes out the lowest of the low and the highest of the high, and then comes up with the mode. I've never been a huge supporter of mode in other areas, as the chair will understand as I make a crack.
Completely.
But would that make a difference in some of these programs?
Representative Mahoney, Mr. Chair, I can't answer that question.
I think it might.
And with that, we better get to the testifiers that live out of the area, because we only have 37 minutes left. So anybody has a question for the commissioner, please give that question to our committee administrator, and she will get to the commissioner and get the answer for you. Or you can probably call the commissioner and she can get directly back to you. And with that, we will start with Patrick Hines from League of Minnesota Cities and Larry Cruz, City Administrator from Thief River Falls. Welcome to our committee, and thank you, Commissioner, very much.
Thank you very much.
I'm amazed how popular you are with the questions. Go ahead, Patrick.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Patrick Hines. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm happy to have Larry Cruz, who's the city administrator for Thief River Falls, here with me today. Mr. Cruz will go through a PowerPoint presentation of a project that Thief River Falls is currently trying to get financed for more workforce housing in the community. I thought if I could take a few minutes just to set the stage for his testimony. There's been a lot of discussion about workforce housing and what exactly workforce housing is. And from the perspective of the League and our member cities, we feel that workforce housing is market rate housing, which is necessary to accommodate job growth in communities that have demonstrated a clear lack of housing stock. Some of the characteristics of these communities would be low vacancy rates, low unemployment rates, low rental rates that hamper the financing of market rate housing. The first question that many people ask when we define workforce housing that way is, if there's such a demand for this workforce housing or market rate housing in a community, why haven't private developers built these housing units? And the short answer is that the cost of building market-rate housing in many greater Minnesota communities far exceeds the amount of money that's available to finance them. And unlike affordable housing, and I use the term affordable housing as a term of art, with whether it's income restricted by state or federal law, there aren't any state programs really to help finance market-rate housing. The longer answer is that in order to finance an apartment building, you're really dependent on the amount of monthly rent those units can command over the life of the project. So you'll have debt service and other costs, and in order to pay that debt service, you're going to have to charge X amount of dollars a month. And in a community like Roseau, for instance, if you're building a new apartment building, you're going to need to charge maybe $1,100 or $1,200 a month in rent. And the average rental rate in Roseau is currently $500 to $600. So it is very difficult to finance a market rate housing project when you have rental rates that low. Just as an example in Roseau, I've used this before, so I'm sorry if I'm repeating, but the cost of the project that's currently being built with some state assistance from the pilot program passed last year is $3.2 million. The appraised value of that project is $2.15 million. So that is very difficult to finance a project that's $1 million underwater before you've even started constructing it. And so that's what we're looking for when we're talking about workforce housing, is how do we fix the problem with the market where we have rental rates that are so low, a private developer can't finance a workforce housing apartment building even though there's great demand for it. And last session, the legislature appropriated $2 million to DEED for a workforce housing pilot program in Roseau and Pennington counties. And Roseau, Thief River Falls, and War Road are the three cities that were eligible. That program will give a grant of up to $400,000, or 10% of the project cost, to a community to help develop workforce housing. The goal of that program is really twofold. One is to create housing so that employers who are willing and ready to expand have a place to put the workers who are going to fill those jobs. And the second long-term goal would be to try to bring upward pressure on the rental rates in those communities so that future projects can be financed through traditional methods. Because right now, the rental rates are so stagnant, you can't get any building done. And so that's my quick summary of what, at the League, we consider workforce housing. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Cruz. He can talk more specifically about the good work they're doing at Thief River Falls.
Welcome to our committee. Would you give your name for the record?
My name is Larry Cruz. I'm the city administrator in Thief River Falls. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for having me here to testify. I'd like to give a little information about the city of Thief River Falls' challenges and opportunities. Thief River Falls is a city of about 8,600 people. There's about 14,000 people in the county. We're a small county. We employ about 10,000 people, and right now we have buses going out as far as Crookston, Grand Forks, and surrounding communities, about 40 miles. And so we're busing employees in from all directions to work in Thief River Falls. We're very fortunate to have DigiKey, and I'm sure you've heard that name before. They employ well over 3,000 people. And right now they're anticipating needing another 350 employees this coming year. Right now, I think they literally could hire 100 people today if they were available, but there just is not housing for those employees. Articat employs about 1,500 people, and they anticipate needing 100 employees this coming year. And then you can imagine with those employers taking up a lot of the employees, the other businesses in the community that we need to thrive and prosper are just really lacking employees. There's many businesses that are can't grow and expand because there just isn't anybody to fill those jobs. And then our college, Northland Community College, has a difficult time finding housing for our students. Right now they've made arrangements with the University of North Dakota to house 50 students 50 miles away, and they're running a bus over there every day bringing those kids back and forth. Now, they put Wi-Fi and some modern conveniences that make that trip a little easier, but it still is a real challenge. Our problem and opportunities. We in 2012, we did a housing study, and it identified that we could use at least 90 housing units per year. Now, we've had a couple developers working with Minnesota Housing. They've been very, very good to us, trying to help us solve this problem. And we've had our own internal problems, some NIMBY situations where housing development was going into a neighborhood, and then the neighborhood revolted, and ultimately we've had two 24-unit developments that did not go forward. Fortunately, that's scheduled into a new area of the city where it will go forward this year. But the city lacked the properly zoned land. We did had little R4 multifamily and R3 multifamily. And one of our challenges is, do you address the problem before bad things happen? And as you know in the media, DigiKey did expand in Fargo, North Dakota, and they have about 400,000 square feet. They're using about 100,000 of that right now. They started just doing warehousing over there, but now they're starting to do a little bit of order fulfillment there. And they really want to be in Thief River. That's where, you know, the hub of their operation is. And for you, for those that may not know, DigiKey did $1.7 billion in business last year. And their goal this coming year is to do about $2 billion. And they are reaching worldwide markets. If you order something from DigiKey, you can literally order it, and within a matter of hours, it's the order's being filled, and it's on a plane to Louisville, Kentucky, and you'll likely receive it in 48 hours to up to 72 hours. And they're doing business in China and Europe every day. And then, like Polaris, you all heard that they're expanding, $142 million expansion in Huntsville. And plans are to employ 1,700 people there. Yeah, we just don't want to get caught with our pants down, so to speak, that DigiKey is all at once expanding somewhere else. The Wall Street Journal visited us this past week, and they were asking, you know, what's the buzz going on in northwestern Minnesota? And so that's great publicity, but then it's also a challenge for us as a city that there are many areas of the country that do have employees, and you can imagine them offering incentives and saying, come to us. So why don't developers build? Our multi-family housing stock is really old. There hasn't been a lot of units brought onto the market. The rents are low. Like Patrick said, $500 and $600 is a typical rent. And then new construction is very expensive to build. And in outstate Minnesota, when you only have one or two employers, no matter how good it is, there's still a certain amount of risk that what will happen with that company. So if you're going to invest money, would you invest in an apartment house in Thief River Falls, or would you go to Grand Forks or Fargo or some bigger metropolitan center? Employers pay a reasonable wage, but it doesn't necessarily support the higher rents. DigiKey is paying approximately $16 an hour when you start there, but their benefit package is, I think it's $23,000, and their income paid to an employee is about $50,000 a year. Now that's really good, and we're very thankful that they have $23,000 in quality medical benefits and that, but that also doesn't pay rents. It's one of the components or challenges that we deal with. And then contractor costs have gone up significantly. We've bid a number of municipal projects, and we have had just one or two bidders, whereas we used to have five or six, and it used to be a lot more competitive. And that's true in the private market. We have an apartment house, a tax increment financing project that was supposed to go last year, but they could not get contractors to build it, and the prices just didn't come in where they could move forward. Lack of student housing is just a real problem, and as you know, students generally occupy it for 9 months, and once again, developers just can't make those projects cash flow. City costs for infrastructure is high, and that doesn't help the ultimate make it affordable for people to rent projects. And we do have tool tax increment financing available, but many of our employees make just too much in order to qualify for that. And so we have kind of a slot in there where you make too much, and yet you don't make enough to do something on the private side. City of Thief River Falls has taken a very proactive approach. We've participated in Minnesota Housing's Housing Institute in Bemidji. We sent a team there. We networked with other communities. They brought developers in, and that was really a great experience for us. We made a lot of connections. We learned. Our proactive approach is that we wanted to get away from the NIMBY syndrome going into a neighborhood where it wasn't accepted. So we've entered into an option to purchase 70 acres very near Articat and Digi-Key, and we have four different phases to that. We pulled the trigger on our first phase, which is 7 acres. That'll net us 5 acres of developable land. Thank you for funding the pilot housing project. We're looking at tapping $400,000 of that. As we looked at trying to use those funds, we wanted to get the most bang for the buck, bang for the state, and bang for the city. So we sent out 23 proposals to developers that we identified as being interested. We had 5 developers that responded to a pre-qualifying round, and then we ended up with 2 that ultimately were interviewed and made proposals to us. We made our process very competitive. We were hopeful to get 40 units. However, we said that we wanted 40 to 100, and we made those 23 developers compete. And we had 2 proposals that came in at 100 units. 50 units in 2 phases. 50 units will be built this summer, and then when that is done, then they'll roll into the next one, assuming that they can do the proper lease up. So the $400,000 of state money will leverage an $8 to $10 million investment in Thief River Falls. We're just finishing up the agreements on that, so we are just tickled that it's going forward. The local match is always a challenge. The state offered $400,000, but then the city had to come up with $400,000. So we went to the county and school, and we asked them to participate. We looked at abatement and other options, and we still have to work out those details, but the county and school agreed. They said they wanted to make this happen. As you can imagine, the school has challenges too. Where do those employees live? So we all deal with this.
Mr. Cruz, we have a very short period of time. We got 3 more testifiers, giving them about 8 minutes apiece. So if you could kind of wrap it up, we'd appreciate it.
And I'll maybe just open up for questions that at this point.
I think we're going to have questions at the end, so we get the other people from out of town here to testify out of courtesy to them. So thank you, and stand by for questions at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you have many problems that the city of Jackson in my district has also.
We're blessed.
Blessed and cursed at the same time.
Thank you.
Next we have Jeff Corey from Duluth. If you can get done in 5 to 8 minutes, I'd be appreciative.
On our marks, get set, go.
There you go.
Thank you, Chair Gunther, representatives. I'm Jeff Corey. I work as the executive director for One Roof Community Housing in Duluth. I'm here today primarily to talk to you about the community land trust work that we do, the affordable homeownership work that we do, and how that sort of fits into what we think of as workforce housing. We use a number of the state resources that Commissioner Tinkerthal talked about earlier. Challenge Fund, the mortgage product that the state has, interim construction dollars, housing infrastructure bonds. This last year when that allocation was made, about $3 million came to community land trusts this fall in the Super RFP awards. Those dollars will result in about 100 units of new housing that happen in the coming years. The folks that we serve in Duluth, our community land trust buyers, come from a wide variety of parts of the community. We have healthcare workers, long-term care workers, clerical workers, manufacturing workers, a lot of folks that work in the schools and in the universities. The average income of the folks that we've served in the last year was about $32,000. This is the sheet that was passed out that refers to some of the statewide work that I'll talk about in a bit. The average mortgage amount, including principal interest, taxes, and insurance for a community land trust buyer in our service area was just over $600 in the last year. One of the unique pieces of our model of doing affordable home ownership work is that the dollars that are invested to make a home affordable are recycled when a buyer decides to, or when one of our homeowners sells. So we like to talk about paying it forward. That's how we talk about the model with our prospective buyers. And so they understand that when they buy one of our homes, they're getting a hand into a house that they otherwise wouldn't be able to afford, a higher quality living situation that their family otherwise wouldn't be able to experience. And in exchange for that, when they sell their home in the future, it'll be the sales price will be restricted. We do that by maintaining ownership of the land and having a resale formula in the lease that we use to lease the land to the person that owns the home. Their sale is restricted in that they get what they paid for the home back when they sell it, and they share the appreciation that happens to the house during the time that they live there. In our case, they get 25% of the appreciation, and the remainder of the appreciation is essentially held by the community to keep the price of the house lower for the next family that buys. It's all a rather complicated situation if you haven't seen it in practice. And oftentimes when we talk in housing circles about the community land trust, folks talk about the model. And one of the things in the recent years I've been really trying to do is to stop using the M word, but rather to talk about the practice. Because in our service area, which includes Duluth, Proctor, Hermantown, Cloquet, Two Harbors, and I'm forgetting someone, Duluth, Proctor, Hermantown, Cloquet, Two Harbors, got them all. In our service area, we have 260 homes. And of those homes, we've had 90 resales happen. The vast preponderance of the folks that have resold their homes move on to market rate home ownership, over 80%, in fact. And so it isn't a model in our communities. It's a practice, and it's a practice that's working. So we offer that. I'm speaking here on behalf of One Roof, but also on behalf of the Minnesota Community Land Trust Coalition. Our state sort of statistics, if you look at the community land trust operating in other places, are the incomes are slightly higher than they would be in Duluth, which makes sense if you think about the fact that the incomes in our service area generally are slightly lower. So $36,000 is the average income of a CLT buyer in the state. Another piece of information is that we do a fantastic job of serving folks of color. 30% of the folks that purchase community land trust homes across the state are households of color. So it's a tool that we're using in communities to really good effect. I don't have a lot more to share with you other than to say that to the extent that community land trusts are a tool that could be used to help with workforce housing needs in various parts of the state, I would offer that we're happy to sit down and assist in terms of talking about what it takes to have a community land trust happen in a community, what it takes to make it work. I've dedicated fully the last 16, 17 years of my life to the work that we've done in our area, and I know that it doesn't happen sort of easily, necessarily, or accidentally for sure. But if one puts time into the planning and the creating of a community land trust, it can be a very, very effective way to not only make folks be able to afford to buy a home and have the American dream that probably all of us had growing up, but we also do that by way of making a one-time investment in that home that passes that on for future generations. So while we have workforce housing needs right now that are seem very big and are very big, this is a tool that could fix the problem for the long term, not just the next 3 to 5 years. So thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. Good tool. And maybe she will answer questions, so if you can stick around if somebody has a question. Next we have Brett Gudeman and Chip Hallback. That'd be nice to Gudeman. He's one of my constituents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Give your name for the record.
My name is Rick Goodman, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm with the Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership. Our offices are located in Slayton, Minnesota, and we work throughout southern and western Minnesota. There is a handout. I don't know if you received it yet. Maybe it's not being distributed. But what I'm here to discuss is workforce housing situation in greater Minnesota. The Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership was formed in 1992 at the end of the farm crisis, and very similar circumstances where southern Minnesota woke up one day and found out that their economy was not diversified enough. There was a lot of resources put, not only at the local level, but the state level, to diversify that income and or that work base, job base. And we did a really good job of creating opportunities for new agricultural-based manufacturing, as well as a more diverse economic base, and created a lot of jobs, which absorbed all of the existing housing. So my organization was really formed to respond to housing shortages that were curtailing economic development, and that was really in 1992. Fast forward 20-some years, and we're back to a similar situation. So through that period of time, we've developed and preserved over 5,000 housing units across southern and western Minnesota. We've used many of the resources that are available through Minnesota Housing Finance Agency that the legislature has appropriated. We've used many of the federal resources that are available. We have served all the entire continuum of the housing need in our region, from very low-income homeless all the way up to mixed income, in response to local need. And we rely very heavily on market studies and housing plans to determine what those needs are and design programs and secure those resources. We have developed and own 1,640 rental units in 44 developments, and that's located on the third page, which basically the yellow is areas that we own and operate housing or have done provided services to local communities. And what we're really talking about is a problem that's been occurring for well over 10 years as economic development created more jobs. It's becoming more and more difficult to respond to that, to create housing resources to house that workforce. After 2008, there was a significant policy shift with the state of Minnesota as we responded to foreclosure prevention, as we responded to increased homelessness, and as we responded to more preservation needs. And the policy shift created a harder ability to access housing resources for new production, and that as it related to low-income housing tax credits. So when we start talking about an affordable need in market rate our workforce housing, we're really talking about a lack of production for the low-income housing tax credit program, which is part of the problem that serves the entry-level workforce. We're talking about another income layering, which is between the low-income housing tax credit of 60% area median income to the challenge grant, which is 80% of statewide median, or $58,000. And we then have a broken market where, as a gentleman from Thief River Falls has talked about, as we've experienced in Jackson, Worthington, and all across southern Minnesota, there is not the ability for the private sector to respond because of low valuations, appraisals, depressed rental rates are making it exceedingly difficult for traditional housing development to occur. So it's a complicated problem. My handout tries to identify the policy issues that are part of the problem, the issues around affordability, and the issues around the fact that the markets are broken in most of our area. So there is a lot of demand. Chip Halbach has some really good information on vacancies. Many of our communities have 0% effective vacancy rates. Many of them from Wilmer have less than 3%. Mankato, St. Peter, Jackson, Worthington. Austin is reporting very low vacancy rates. So it's a widespread problem, and we have not been able to utilize many of the tools through Minnesota Housing Finance Agency for new production. True, there's been new production, but it's been most of those funds have been utilized to support foreclosure response, preservation, and projects that have a sizable proportion of low and moderate or homeless and supportive housing units, which I don't argue that's very much a need, but we now have a need to support economic development before we start losing those jobs, as also was part of the testimony from Thief River Falls.
Right. Mr. Chair, Chip Halbach with Minnesota Housing Partnership, and I know we're tight, so about how many minutes would you want me to go here? Or seconds? Two? Okay, Commissioner Tinkerthal talked some about our work across Minnesota. We've worked with over 200 communities and organizations throughout the years. I do want to just hone in on a couple of things since we've had a theme of market studies. Our agency does fund numerous market studies across greater Minnesota. And the Minnesota Housing, in fact, has a great collection of them. In fact, we have a summary of over 400 recent needs assessments. But I'm going to focus here on ones for in greater Minnesota for rental housing. In the last few years, 30 of those were completed. Of those 30, some 83% identified a tight rental market, you know, somewhat similar to what we have here in the Twin Cities. Four of the communities, in fact, had an effective market rental market vacancy rate of 0%. And who are those communities? So in the extremely low rates from these market studies, it's the Crow Wing County, it's in the Brainerd area, Roseau, Stewartville, Red Wing, Olmsted County, and then in otherwise below 3%, Grand Rapids, Isani, Duluth, Mille Lacs, you know, and on and on. So that, so as the other information that was passed out to the committee, you see across the state that there is significant housing need, and you have in some greater Minnesota communities low vacancy rates and rents climbing a lot, others just low vacancy rates. I think in terms of where we need to go is that the workforce is, as speakers have said, really growing in at least some 30-some greater Minnesota communities we could point to. And that's a workforce where you have the range of incomes that run from the $9, $10, $11 an hour up to the engineers in Roseau who are making $70,000, all unable to find housing. Minnesota Housing's program are great for the vast majority of those households, but not all. And that's why the work of this committee will be, and also Representative Garofalo's committee will be very important, because for the lower income workers, we have a shortage of resources. It's unfortunate that the governor's budget did not include a continuation of the jobs and housing initiative, but that's for the legislature to deal with. Also then, we're working with Greater Minnesota Housing Fund and others to figure out a way for those higher income workers where the market isn't coming in because of the shortage of capital and also the risk level and the low prevailing rents, a way over time to build up the rent levels in those communities where there is some buying power so that less resources would need and the private capital would come in and fill more of that need. And so we're working with a number of Greater Minnesota developers, for-profit, non-profit, public, to try to sort of crack this nut, which ranges from the affordability program, the traditional affordable housing program, up to some new tools that are needed to loosen up where the market is tight, even for higher income renters.
Thank you very much. Hopefully we have some time for questions afterwards, otherwise we'll have to make time. Chip, you can come back.
I might.
We have Ernesto Bustos. I hope I didn't ruin Ernesto's name. From Bogota. Welcome to our committee. Give your name so I know for sure what it is.
Yep. And I'll be quick. I know we have 4 minutes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
2 minutes overall.
2 minutes? All right. My name is Ernesto Velez Bustos. I'm the executive director of Centro Campesino based out of Owatonna, Minnesota. And we've been operating out of that office for the past 15 years. In the past 15 years, we have also had temporary offices, per se, in many different communities across rural Minnesota, Montgomery, St. Peter, Rochester, Austin, and Owatonna. And we've seen through the past 15 years kind of the same trend. And, you know, listening to the testimonies earlier, it is true that across southern Minnesota, we would see that each community has different needs when it comes down to housing. But a couple of things kind of think to stick out and think to turn to prevail. And one of them for the Latino community that we continue to see is, of course, the enormous gap that we have, a 44% gap between Latino home ownership and the rest. And that's for us something that is very preoccupying in terms of how we move forward in the future of the Latino families living in Minnesota, not just because these families are here and are established and want to continue to be here, but in order to also secure that future for themselves and for their children. Home ownership is one key piece, especially when we're starting to have and to see multi-generational families living in housing conditions that are not appropriate, and also that they do not have the right tools and the right capacity sometimes to move out of that system. And in addition, for us, the Latino community in southern Minnesota or rural Minnesota across the state, we also do not have the right vehicles in terms to how to communicate, how to educate, and how to even bring these issues not only from the community to this level in terms of the committee, but also the other way around. So bringing these resources, bringing this education, and bringing these investments into these communities is also part of our one of our challenges.
That's a big challenge.
A lot.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I had St. James and Medillia in my district, so I know what you're talking about. Okay, questions. We have Representative Barrett.
Yeah, I just have a quick question for Mr. Cruz, if he's still here. So, Mr. Cruz, you had mentioned Polaris as a employer in Thief River Falls. They're also in Chisago County. You mentioned them as a company who left to Huntsville, Alabama. You referenced housing, which I'm sure is a part of why they left. Can you explain kind of the economic incentives that were around either in Huntsville? As you were talking, I went online and looked at the press release, actually the TV video, and it was quite the celebration they had down there in Huntsville. The mayor there announced all kinds of incentives that they received, both state and local. They also went down there because they're making all-terrain vehicles, and they probably want to branch out into Southeast Market. So a lot of reasons, but I'm curious about that and what you know about that decision. Because, I mean, while Thief River Falls may not have had the workforce. Certainly, Chisago County does. And I think if we looked at every area of the state, we could find room for Polaris and their 1,700 workers that they are now finding in Alabama.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, I'm actually, Articat is the competitor to Polaris, and so Polaris is in Roseau, and Articat is in Thief River Falls, and I was just sharing that as an example of, you know, sometimes we're not always aware that when companies are moving and making plans, I know there are some big incentive packages. From my perspective as city administrator in Thief River, I just want to make sure that that doesn't happen there, that we keep our homegrown employers growing. So I can't specifically answer, you know, on the incentive side of that.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Polaris is also in Spirit Lake, Iowa, by the way.
Yes.
So any other questions? Yes.
I actually have a question, Chair, for the Commissioner, if she could come back.
She. Thank you very much, Mr. Cruz.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Just very quickly, just if you could help me understand the definition, 30% of income for housing, so 30% of gross or net, and then for housing, is that rent plus utilities, mortgage plus utilities? What is that calculation? If you could help me understand that a little bit better.
Yes, 30% of income is gross.
Okay.
And it generally will include, for on the homeownership side, principal, interest, taxes, insurance, utilities, and also on the rental side, it will include rent plus utilities.
Okay. Members, I'd like to ask you all to keep your information in your folders, because we're going to continue this next meeting. And I appreciate those people who came here that didn't get to testify, and I hope everybody that did got a chance to say all he wanted to say. I appreciate you, particularly Mr. Cruz. You came a long ways. Thank you very much. And this meeting is adjourned.